I want to talk to you about what I believe is our special place. A special place that I think the founders of this country knew that we were supposed to occupy as Americans, but a special place that I think we are also supposed to occupy. Indeed, if America is to succeed, a special place that we must occupy in this nation's life as believers. And I know that more and more people, thank God, are waking up to this truth in America. But I wonder if it's enough, and I wonder if it will be in time. You do have to wonder when you cannot turn around without seeing before you some evidence that the decay and corruption of this nation's life has gone much further than I think most of us would ever have imagined possible. But just before I left home, we were watching the usual newscasts and seeing another instance, this time a 10-year-old who was being held for 2 counts of rape. And those were the two he was caught doing. Think about it. Others then emerged. 10 years old. I don't cite something like that in order to be shocking, because to tell you the truth, I have a feeling that it's hard to shock people anymore. This is part of our problem. We are actually, I think, starting to read these stories. The 10-year-olds being raped by the 14-year-olds, the 16-year-olds killing the 15-year-olds, the 6-year-olds leading assaults on 4-month-old babies. Did you hear about that one? We are starting to hear so much about these things that I think we're actually getting to the point where we believe or start to feel somehow unconscious. This is normal. And that's the first thing that I think we have to put aside. This is not normal. Babies having babies. Remember we were worried about that? But that was just the beginning, because now the babies are killing the babies. But I think as we think it through this evening, we're going to realize that the really shocking truth does not lie in the babies killing the babies and what is devouring the children. The really shocking truth lies in the way in which we have allowed an environment to be created in which those young people are no longer feeling a prevailing wind in this nation, blowing them in the right direction. Instead, they walk as if through a fog. The bright stars that ought to be their guides, that ought to give them some sense of right and wrong and conscience, blocked out by an obfuscation that has become so prevalent that sometimes we don't even notice it anymore. We just take it for granted. And we've heard arguments such that when we open our mouths to do anything about it, we are told that we don't have the right to talk about these things in public places. See, I have noticed, have you, that what started out as this doctrine of the separation of church and state has now been translated into a broader doctrine, the separation of public life from morality. It's true. Now, I've got to tell you, you observe the way some of our politicians behave, and it seems they're quite determined to respect that separation. But what we have to ask ourselves, what we have to ask ourselves as human beings, as Christians, as Americans, is whether or not it is right for us to sit by and passively accept these ideas when we can already see the consequences that are being wrought by them. There is no longer any doubt. You see, 20 years ago, I could remember when I was in college arguing about what would be the consequences of Roe versus Wade and so forth, and we used to speculate on the things that would result. And it was all speculation. But now you look at the world that has come about since the 60s, and our worst speculations weren't bad enough to account for the reality that we face. The reality that has filled our streets with crime and violence, that has filled our schools with fear, and that has now reached into younger and younger generations of Americans, not just to distract their attention, but to destroy their lives, indeed, their very souls. And why? Well, when you raise the question why, when you start to deal with the issues that might somehow lead us to take these problems seriously, you're liable to be told. This is not the business of public life. Oh, it's all right if you're in a pulpit. But have you noticed that if you confine your concern with moral things to Sunday morning or to Sunday afternoon, the rest of the week starts to look pretty bleak. And this is happening in America. Now, I know you've heard some things today that will remind you that some of the things that we've been told about this famous separation of church and state, separation of the public things and of religious feeling, highly questionable. But I actually believe that it's more than questionable. And the logic of it is so simple that I do not understand how we could have let these things go on. I really don't. But let's start at the beginning. What is America about? If you were to sum it up in one word, what would that word be? Of course. Now, some time back, I was watching a television show on PBS, I'll Fly Away. They were replaying that series. And they had a scene where four black guys were gathered together planning their next sit-in or whatever in the 50s. Now, this was a scene that I thought was very reminiscent of many scenes in American history, though they would like us to forget them, where after they had gotten through with their planning and they had reached that point where they wanted to encourage themselves to have heart for the challenges they were going to face, what did they do you think? They prayed. And in this, they stood in a great long tradition of American life, starting with the founders themselves, who had better sense than to do anything without turning first to their God who made them. And then after they prayed, they joined their hands, and I thought the juxtaposition of these things was beautiful and appropriate, and they sang a bit of a spiritual that was kind of one of the anthems of the civil rights movement. It went something like this. Oh, freedom, oh, freedom, oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. And so there they were, praying. They were praying, and at the same time, they were representing, to me at least, that connection that Americans have always made between that which is considered to be most precious in our public lives, that freedom, and our reverence for God and our dependence on Him. And I always thought it was appropriate, too, because where did they take that courage from? Have you ever considered that as you look back at the history of the world, so many times in so many places, a very few people were able to oppress and rule over great masses of people and deprive them of all freedom? I've always wondered how that could have been possible. But I think the reason it was possible has a little something to do with that phenomenon that you're reminded of if you ever see some of the old westerns, where they have the scene where the sheriff stands off the mob. And there's the sheriff all by himself. There's a prisoner in the jail or something, and they've come to lynch him, and he's standing up for the law. And the sheriff is having his little back and forth with the mob, and there might be 50, 100, 200 people. And during those scenes, you always wonder, if the sheriff and his little deputy or something, why don't they just rush him and get it over? But think about it. If you analyze that situation, it may be a little harder than it looks, because there's always that question when you're going to rush the sheriff as he's standing there with his shotgun or his pistol. And he reminds them of this at some point in the little discourse. He'll say, yeah, you can rush me, but I'll get one or two of you before you get me. And that means that there's always that question about who's going to go first. Probably answered by one of those few times when everybody rediscovers the virtues of real politeness. No, you go first. Maybe that's where people discovered it as a virtue for the first time. And somewhere in the midst of that, it becomes pretty apparent that nobody really wants to be the one who dies so that somebody else can be hanged. This does not usually seem worth the trouble. And eventually everybody disperses and goes home. But that question, who's going to go first when you are faced with the possibility of certain death, is one of the things, I think, that has allowed a few people to often, for good purpose or bad, cow, intimidate, rule over, oppress masses of people. Because in order for the many to have the courage to defend their worth, each one must find it in themselves first. And how do you find that courage? When the thought that must be in your mind is that if you take the first step, then you're going to be out there on point all by yourself. I know how so many Americans in the past have found it. They found it just as those four men around the table found it. They found it by remembering that according to our creed, if you are standing there for justice sake, then you are not standing there alone. Right at the very beginning of this nation's life, they told us of the connection between justice and that power which can take us through all the challenges. Why have we forgotten this? And it seems like we have. That's why I say it's very simple. You go back to the beginning and you read the words of that great Declaration of Independence. Understanding, first of all, its real significance. Because when our founding fathers wrote the Declaration, what were they doing? They were about to embark on a war. Now, unlike some people today, I think our founding fathers understood that you don't go to war lightly. That war is not a game, because when you go into war, especially the war they were going into, a war where they were going to risk their homes and their families against what was then acknowledged to be the greatest military power in the world, one that had already defeated great powers in Europe, already won wars in the United States, they had to feel pretty intimidated. And I suppose if there had been odds makers in those days, or pundits the way we have them now, they would surely have sat around on the McLaughlin group or one of those places and commented on how crazy those lunatic revolutionaries were to think that they could take on the British Empire. So they didn't take the decision to go to war lightly. But most importantly, not only in terms of what they risked, but understanding that what they risked went beyond material things. Well, you see, war is about risking your life and your goods, but it is also about taking the lives of others, quite possibly. And what greater moral burden could there be than the knowledge that you had taken the lives of others for no good reason? So they felt they had to justify the step in moral terms. And it was that sense that led to the famous words of the Declaration, in which they stated the moral premises, the terms of justice, which led them to rebel. And what were the premises they stated? We all know these words. Now, we do, you know. We still do, most of us. I sometimes fear that our children don't know them as well as we did, and that our children's children may not know them very well at all. I may not understand them, and even when they hear them, may find that they have been strangely transmuted. But you know what they are. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created. See, I always like to pause on the word created. Well, it's a good thing. We ought to pause on the word created because it will remind us. It will remind us of this very important fact. We like to rush right over to that word equal. All of us like to do it these days so we can go out and as quickly as possible whine about our rights. But that is not the first step. You can't get to the equal unless you go through the created. And then you go to the next step and are endowed, and here's the part that can be particularly embarrassing these days, and are endowed by their creator. I am sure that this comes as a sobering shock, particularly to some folks in the ACLU who have been telling, well, they've been telling people for years, including kids in our schools, that their rights come from the Bill of Rights. I heard one of them, I think his name is Barry Lynn or somebody, he was on a panel with me. And it was so second nature to them that in the course of some throwaway remark he made, and he said, my rights as granted to me by the Bill of Rights. I had to take advantage of the moment when I took the floor to tell him that his rights may have been granted by the Bill of Rights, but that I was going to stick to the first truth, the old truth, the true truth of the Declaration. My rights were granted to me by the Creator God, by the will beyond human will. By the will beyond human will, by the power beyond human power. And that means that when we stand up for those rights, we stand up not confident in our own strength, but confident rather in the strength and power of God. That his right arm will strike for justice. And even should ours prove weak, his will prevail. Imagine what strength that has given to Americans over the years. This was the strength to fight the revolution. This was the strength to fight slavery in the worst times and the darkest days when it looked like it could never be turned around. This was the strength to stand up for workers' rights and women's rights and children's rights and every right you can think of. This was the strength to stand and bear witness to faith no matter what the opposition, because we understood that we are not alone. See, this is something that, according to the astronomy magazine I was reading the other day, the scientists are just discovering. So nice to know that we Christians have been ahead of them all this time in that knowledge. But we Americans also, understanding that in the struggle for right and justice, we do not rely only on a human strength. Now that's the good part. Good in the sense that it offers us hope. There's another part, equally good, but maybe from the point of view of some, less appealing. And that's the part that goes like this. If our rights come from the Creator God, what happens to our rights if we reject God's existence and deny his authority? It's sort of like a house where the foundation's been torn away. Hard to imagine being endowed with rights by a God who does not exist at the time. Really, this is hard. That simple fact, though, ought to have some clear, serious consequences for us in our thinking. And I wonder if they do. That simple fact means that if somebody comes along and offers us an understanding of liberty or freedom or rights that is based on the notion that we are the ultimate arbiter of our rights, what have we to do with that understanding? See, and this is not an academic question. In the course of my little endeavors in the presidential campaign, you probably noticed that I was one of those people who refused to go anywhere unless I was able to talk about the issue that I believe is of central importance to the moral challenge we face as a people, the issue of abortion. Now, matter of fact, it went so far that y'all looked for me real hard at the Republican convention, and you didn't find me. And the reason was that the condition of walking through the door and up to the podium was that you leave that word behind. And I refuse to leave the word behind, and I refuse to leave the issue behind, because I believe that it poses the greatest threat to America's character and America's future. And why? But you see, I think though that we have to think through why that is. Why is that? Well, it's because when they come to you with the abortion doctrine, what do they say? It is a woman's choice whether or not to take that life in the womb. Isn't that what they say? Okay. So since it is wrong to take the life of a human being arbitrarily, we can't do that, as a matter of fact, because we have this right, unalienable right to life. That means we're putting the mother in a position where she is the arbiter of the child's humanity and of its rights. To borrow a phrase from the Dred Scott decision, the child in the womb has no rights which its mother has to respect. She determines that. So she is the one who decides whether the child is human or not human. Whether the child has rights or no rights, whether therefore the child shall be treated as a human life, and babies are beautiful and must be nurtured and cared for, and you stop smoking and drinking and everything to make sure it's healthy, or shall it be treated as so much garbage scraped out and flushed down the toilet? That's her decision. But we ought to have a problem with this, because if that's her decision, that means that the mother, a human will, ultimately determines whether the child is human, whether it has rights, whether it lives or dies. And right there in our own creed, and I do not mean by this our own religious creed, but our own American creed, what does it say? It says that not a man and not a woman and not a court and not a judge, not a president and not a Congress, and not a Constitution or a Bill of Rights, but God Almighty determines that we are human and determines that we have rights. And if we take seriously the language that was used, I think we would also know this. Anybody here have children? Good. How many of you believe that you created those children? Now think carefully about this. I have some folks outside with rubber jackets waiting for you. See, I know, I have children. I have, however, not lately mistaken myself for their creator. I don't know why. That means that if someone uses the word creation in its true sense, are they talking about anything we had to do with? How many of you were there, present at the creation? See, that went on in God's time, not in our time. And that means that if all men are created equal, that fact and the rights that flow from it are not in any way a consequence of our human will, of our human judgment, of our human determination. That is what I think the Declaration really intended to remind us of, to remind all of us that authority by which we claim to stand in dignity is an authority beyond our reach and beyond our will, and which implies a discipline upon our will, that we have not only to accept the rights and whine about the freedom and insist on the equality, we have also to respect the fact that there is a boundary to what we can do, to what we can claim, to what we can rightly profess to be our authority. And so if somebody comes to you with this abortion doctrine, what they're doing is they're taking the Declaration doctrine and throwing it out. And they're saying, we'll put you up on that throne in the place of God Almighty. You create the children. You determine their humanity. You determine their rights. You are God Almighty. And don't you see that I have just stated in political terms that which is the heart of our challenge, of our moral corruption in every term? For what we are doing in this time is putting our own will on the throne that belongs to God and worshiping it as if we were the Creator. And the Declaration, that document which is the foundation stone of this nation's institutions, if it does anything, it especially warns us against that mistake. It reminds us that we must never accept the doctrines that replace God's will with our will when it comes to determining basic human life, basic human worth, basic human rights. And that's what we're doing. And the consequences are pretty devastating. I went through this kind of reasoning time and again during the course of the campaign, and speeches and other things that had nothing to do with it. I wonder if we really understand how far the consequences extend of this, both of our failure to appreciate it and of the things we could rediscover if we learned to appreciate it anew. It is again why I spent so much time concentrating on this issue of abortion, because after all, once we have accepted this doctrine, what are the practical consequences of it? Well, the first consequence is that the children, they cease to have any claim to our respect in and of themselves. If we respect their lives, it is only because as a function of our needs, of our will, of our convenience, we decided it was convenient to have them around. But you know, children grow up to be adults, and the attitude that you extend to the children is actually one that you are extending to humanity as such. So instead of taking the view that human beings have an intrinsic kernel of dignity, a spark, as it were, of God's will in them, we instead regard them only as a function of our needs. And what happens then? Well, if you happen to need an automobile and somebody else owns it, is that going to stand in your way? No, it's not. If you happen to need to make a profit and somebody else is going to suffer for it, is that going to stand in your way? No, it will not. Once we start to treat people as if they are instruments of our will instead of creatures of God's will, then everything that we understand to be justice is destroyed. There is no difference any longer between right and wrong, good and bad, except what happens to look good to us today. And as it is said in Judges, every man becomes his own judge and does what is right in his own eyes. This is our time. And the consequence of that, in the strictest and most intimate terms, especially growing out of abortion, can be clearly seen, because what is the first thing that happens? I have, for the longest time when I think about this, been put in mind of the biblical story of Pharaoh. And how, at every turn, when Moses would approach Pharaoh and the different plagues came upon Egypt, the phrase that keeps recurring is, "And God hardened Pharaoh's heart." Because Pharaoh, of course, thought he was God. And as you become prey to that delusion, your heart becomes harder and harder. Mothers harden their hearts against their offspring until, like Susan Smith, they get in the way and can be shoved off into a lake and killed. Oh, we pretended, I know, to be a nation shocked by this terrible crime. But somebody has to explain to me how we can be a nation shocked at that terrible crime of two young children being put in the backseat of a car and drowned by their mother, and yet we are not shocked every time a woman walks into an abortion clinic to do what is in principle the same thing to her children. And God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and abortion is hardening America's heart. It hardens the heart of fathers against their offspring. And not only do we let fathers harden their hearts, we demand that they do. We tell them that child in the womb as it grows is no concern of theirs. What is the most? I would almost say the most. It's one of the most powerful instincts for men in human life. What is it? The instinct to do what? To protect your children. Comes right after the instinct for your own survival. It has been identified almost everywhere and always by civilizations and non-civilizations to be one of those things that is the hallmark of decent male humanity. That when your children are threatened, you will spring to their defense. And yet we in this society are telling men that they must stand by while their offspring are destroyed in the womb and they can have nothing whatsoever to say about it. What kind of men are we? Unmanned in our very souls by a doctrine that has our children snatched from us before they even come into the world without a by your leave. This hardens men's hearts. After all, if it's not my child in the womb, how come it suddenly becomes my child in the world? What's the big difference? No big difference at all. So if you force me to abandon the child emotionally in the womb, how can you be surprised if I then turn my back on it once it appears in this world? Oh, and you'll read the paper, and all the experts will tell you that children are at great risk and that they're being abused and that they're being abandoned and that more and more we're seeing children without fathers being raised because their fathers are begetting them and abandoning them. And we talk about personal responsibility. Clinton does and Dole does and all these people talk like they want to return it. Well, if you want to return to personal responsibility, tell me, how are we to achieve that in this most basic relationship? If we are forcing men to abandon their emotional relationship with their child in the womb. We can't have it both ways. See, we can't practice the abortion doctrine and then run around the world pretending that we want to reestablish that sense of responsibility which is the basis for family life. It will not happen. And that, again, means that this issue and the truth it represents point to that which is the most serious challenge, the most serious source of moral corruption in our time. A corruption in our understanding of freedom itself. That freedom which is the hallmark of our society. That freedom for the sake of which our patriot dead endured and died. That freedom, the blessings of which are promised to our posterity, and the curses of which we see on our streets every day. They like to pretend, you know, and in the midst of all this political stuff, we're going to see a lot of pretending. You'll excuse me this evening if I seem somewhat even-handed in my rebuke of the politician. Because on any given day of the week, I could give you a pretty long discourse on the major differences that subsist between the two parties. And probably give you a pretty good list of my reasons for thinking that maybe this one ought to get your vote rather than that one. But there's something that I think I'd want to share with you this evening that goes beyond all that. See, because look at what they're insisting on talking about. If you look at our political discourse in America today, what is it that these people seem to believe is our major challenge? Handling what? The economy. Handling the money. They really want us to believe that as we look around this country, as we see generation after generation sinking into the mire of promiscuity and drugs and violence and crime in the street and deteriorating education, they want us to believe that somehow or another at the root of those problems, is a money problem. That our economic situation explains that. If that were the case, how come we didn't have all these problems during the Great Depression? How come the families weren't falling apart? How come the crime rate actually fell? We need to look with great suspicion on these explanations. I don't see how they could be true. Think about this one. I was just looking in the paper the other day at a little chart that someone had done, talking about drug use, because they issued this study the other day in which they pointed out that the drug use among young people continues to spike. And right there was a chart, and it showed that during the course of the 80s to around, 1992, the whole drug problem had declined among the young people. And then starting in 1992, there was a sudden increase, and it's just gone up. Now, I'm not going to dwell on what happened in 1992. But I will say this. During the course of the so-called Reagan years, there was a program identified with Nancy Reagan about the drug problem called Just Say No. Remember that? I sometimes wonder if everyone understood the real significance of that program. A lot of the usual suspects laughed and all of this, because the idea, by the way, that human beings might actually be able to control themselves in some area is considered laughable by many of those who fancy themselves to be sophisticated in our time. I still have to wonder, though, about their reasoning, because these are the same people, by the way, who think that we ought to recycle, save the whale, and so forth and so on. They're also likely to be the same people who think we ought to stop smoking and eat less fat and exercise. But I was saying, if you can't control your lust, right, then what makes people think you can control your anger? Therefore, you can no more control violence than you can control sexual passion. So the people who come to us and say, you can't control sexual passion, how can they get all upset as violence rises? Because obviously you can't control violence either. Isn't this right? If you abandon the moral premise in one area, you abandon it in every area. Either we are, as human beings, capable of restraining and disciplining and controlling our passionate impulses, or we're not. So this idea behind the drug program that you could just say no, they laughed at it, and it worked, of course. Well, because we are human beings. We are capable of moral control. It's one of the reasons that no matter how mad you get at me the next few minutes, you probably won't come up here and kill me or anything. That's true. I pointed this out to a professor at Boston College at one point. She got all upset with me because I used her as the example. You know, I said, no matter how upset I might get at the absurd ideas of what will restrain me from violence, I can control myself. Just say no. See, just say no wasn't just about calculating the health consequences. It wasn't just about figuring out that if you smoke this much and so, these dangers will result and your health will deteriorate. Frankly, as I get more experience, and I don't have that much, but I'm getting a little more every day with children as they come into adolescence in particular, I don't understand why anybody thought that telling kids that drugs are dangerous would lead them to stop using them. It doesn't lead them to stop doing any of the other dangerous things we tell them are dangerous. Matter of fact, sometimes I think you tell children it's dangerous, it makes it more attractive to them when they get to be around 14 or 15. Oh, they're trying to prove that they're bigger than we are. So they do things that are quite stupid. They do things that they would never have dreamt of doing when they were six. It's one of those things about life. No, and Nancy Reagan had the right point, though, because what she was doing and what was being done in that idea was not to get them all calculating, but to get them to understand that there are certain things in this life about which you don't calculate. About which you say, well, here's the standard that defines the difference between right and wrong, and here's the action. If it doesn't come up to the standard, just say no. That's morality. And what I'm trying to get across in that is that when we abandoned that understanding that the challenge that faced us in this area was in fact a challenge in restoring a sense of moral discipline, character, and capacity to our young people, we start to lose the battle again. And I believe we will lose all the battles until we have been willing to restore that sense of the primacy of the moral challenge in every area and everything we face and do. Starting, of course, with those things which we do as a people. Oh, I know that there are people out there who will tell you that you got to reform the behavior first and then the laws will follow, but I don't know what world they've been living in. They haven't been around this planet for very long, apparently, because it never worked that way. No. No. Tocqueville said somewhere, first men make laws, then the laws make men. And so if you have on your books an abortion doctrine that destroys the sense of moral limit, how then can you acknowledge that there are moral limits? If you adopt an understanding of freedom that destroys the sense of moral capacity, how are you going to educate your children to believe that they have a moral capacity? Not going to happen. And so the laws we tolerate, the public policies that we allow, they can, on a large scale, undo the work that we might try to do, one child at a time, one heart at a time, one soul at a time. Okay? Now, this doesn't mean that we don't do that work, but this means that we understand, I believe, that the work we do in that regard helps us to do the other work, and that that other work helps us to do the work of individual salvation. The two things are not exclusive. They go hand in hand. As we reach for the truth of our individual salvation, as we long for that and work for that, of all of those around us, starting with our family and those others we encounter, so also I believe we have to respect and recognize that we have in America a very special version of that challenge of salvation, which extends to our entire nation. For how shall we sustain this land of freedom based upon the will of God if God is banished from our law and banished from our discourse and banished from our public policy? If all respect for his will and all sense of discipline resulting from that respect is banished from our schools and from the hearts of our children? It can't be done. So when they come to you and they tell you they're going to solve all your problems with a tax cut, I hope you're suspicious. Now, I have a long history in that regard. Everybody knows I've never seen a tax cut I didn't like. But it's not because I'm greedy for this or that money. I actually think it has to do with respecting our moral capacity. If you take away all the material wherewithal for people to meet their responsibilities, how are they supposed to exercise their moral capacity? It can't be done. So there is a moral purpose behind tax cutting sometimes. But when they come along in an election year and decide that they're going to increase the minimum wage and cut the taxes, you have one party bribing the poor and another party trying to bribe the working people and other people trying to bribe the rich. It's all about that. Don't fool yourself. They may or may not ever get to what is really important for the country. But we must get there. That is our job. For in the end, this nation is ours to make or break. Its character, its strength, its ultimate fate are in our hands. And what are we going to do? I think that's a question especially put to Christian people in this time. And I have resolved that over the course of the next several years, it's going to be one of my main purposes in life to go everywhere I possibly can and look at everybody I can find who is a person of Christian faith or of religious conviction. And I'm going to say, are you someone who is right this minute taking an active interest in the public life of this country, of the schools, and of the community, and of the state, and of the nation? See? Because if we do not take that interest, then you explain something for me. This nation rests on the premise of God's authority and God's existence. Who's going to defend that premise? The atheists? I hardly think so. The agnostics? They're too busy making up their minds, I think. If that is indeed the premise of this nation's life, then who must be the leaven in this life? Who must be the salt of the saltness here? If not the people of God who are called by his name, who profess in their life to be believers that he is, and that his will must govern and has saved us all. That's a special burden for us. A special burden of faith, I believe, as it must be also a special burden of patriotism. Now, I know that there are some people who will argue that seems somewhat contrary to Christ's teaching. I've heard this argument. I really don't need to read it anymore, Jim. I kind of know it. But yeah, you can give it to me. He wants to hand me the Bible. But because every now and again I like to deal with that passage of the Bible, especially when I'm talking to folks who I know have read it more often than the Supreme Court reads the Constitution. Because there is that famous phrase in the Bible, which has been used, I think, by some to pretend that Christ himself sanctioned this doctrine of the separation of church and state. And that therefore there's some secret seductive wickedness going on. If you try to lure people out of the pews and the churches and into the arena of public life and public policy as citizens. Because did not the Lord say, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's? Didn't he say that? Sounds like separation of church and state. But let's go back to that passage. Can I do that here? Do I have your permission? Can I read from the Bible? Yes. Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Master, we know that thou art true and teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, see, why tempt me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money. And they brought him a penny. And he said to them, whose is this image and superscription? And they said unto him, Caesar's. Then saith he unto them, render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. That's the whole passage. Now see, this passage posed a great dilemma for me for the longest time, because in the very same book of Matthew, when the Lord is giving his famous Sermon on the Mount, He says this, Matthew 6:24. No man can serve two masters, for either he will love the one, or he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Seems to me there's a problem here. Because you read the second passage that I just read. It was actually the first passage, but you read that. And then, in light of that, you hear Christ saying, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Almost would suspect Christ of being a politician. Well, have you ever thought that politicians have two mouths? Tuck out of both of them at the same time? Yes. Now, I've got to tell you, the Lord, who is my friend, never does things like that. Matter of fact, that friendship has, in spite of my involvement with politics, kept me from becoming a politician. It's a good thing. So I read a passage in which it seems like the Lord is a politician, and you know, I've got to say, well, something must be wrong here. My understanding is right. And so I spent a long time trying to, over the years, grapple with this passage, and then one day the Lord blessed me with a little understanding, I think. And it was an understanding that kind of came like this. Christ is the Word made flesh. Is that not right? Well, that means that Christ's deeds are words, and his words are deeds. Right? So if you're reading through a passage and you don't understand the words, you've got to look at the actions that go along with them. And what action goes along with these words? He says, show me a penny, show me a denarius. And they show him the penny and says, hey, whose image is on here? This is, in my opinion, the key to this passage. Christ gives it to us in that gesture. But what does he tell us? You want to know what belongs to whom? Ask, whose image is stamped upon it? See? And what do we find? If you go back to the very beginning, when all the Pharisees, see, they didn't have the New Testament, they had the old one. But listening to Christ's words, in light of that Old Testament, this is why their jaw dropped and they all went away marveling. Because the answer he gave wasn't a politician's answer at all. Because unlike most of the politicians, he said this and he said that, but he said the truth. While he said this and that. Whose image is stamped upon whom? It says right here, Genesis 2. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. So you think about it, he says the image of Caesar is on the coin. Well, whose image is on Caesar? Whose image is on you? Whose image is on me? Whose image is on everything that is stamped with the power and that must acknowledge the majesty of the Creator God? See, Christ was not saying that you give a little to Caesar and you give a little to God and you go away like the Pharisees feeling good about yourself. He was reminding the very Pharisees that Caesar belongs to God and you belong to God and I belong to God. It all belongs to God. Give it back to him. That's what he was saying. And that means that if we as people of faith are going to follow Christ's words and example, are we gonna listen when they tell us that the separation of church and state means that we take that discipline, we take that heart, we take that understanding, which is the understanding born of our faith through Jesus Christ, and we leave it at the church door when it comes time to be citizens? We cannot accept that. For if we accept that, we are in fact rejecting the example, the essence, the truth of our faith. For Christ time and again tells us that it is not just in the words, but in the deeds that you must be judged. And that the Pharisees who were whited sepulchres, professing a belief in God that they did not put into action, were beneath his contempt and would have no place in the kingdom of heaven. For by faith we are saved. But by faith also, our life is transformed. And so, shall it be true of this nation? And this is the only thing that will save us. See, but how is it going to happen? I know, and I deeply believe, in the end, it is going to happen when the Lord and Savior comes again to establish the true reign of justice, of which this justice we seek is but a pale shadow. And yet in this life, as we are here to be his witnesses, what does it mean for us? Whose voice shall be his voice? Whose eye shall be his eyes? Whose hand shall be his hand? And as he bade us with his knowledge to tend the sick, because there also is he, and to visit those in prison, and to clothe the naked, and to see in all that we see in this world the understanding that as we care for it, we care also for Christ Jesus in all those who are the creatures of God. Is that not also true of this great nation, born only by his divine providence, sustained only in the end by the fact that it was born in an acknowledgement that his will is the source of justice, that his power is the strength of right. I think that this is the challenge that we face. And as in all these things, they tell us the answers in some complicated tome somewhere that will give us the right budget and the right fiscal policy and so forth. I think it is. But I think in the end, the right budget and the right fiscal policy will be very clear. Do you know what the right budget for law enforcement is in a community ruled by Christian faith? Do you know what the right budget for welfare is in a community ruled by Christian faith? What then, if you go through every single one of these, the right budget for crime, the right budget for violence, the right budget for all these ills we face, not the money that we are throwing after these problems and making them worse and worse, but rather a restoration of the moral commitment on the basis of which this nation was founded. And only one group of people in this nation have the heart and have the faith to rediscover that moral commitment and carry it once again, whatever the cost, into the arena of our public affairs. That people is you. And if your life, if your fire of faith does not reignite the flame of decency in this nation, then nothing will. That is your challenge, it is your work, and this nation's future, in fact, is in your hands. And so I would ask you, whatever has been the grim reality presented to you today, in terms of the moral problems, in terms of the economic problems, whatever it is that this nation faces as a challenge, what I think we have to understand is that as it was when this nation began, as it was when it fought for liberty in the beginning, as it was when others fought against slavery in the last century, as it was when we went over the seas to fight against despotism and tyranny unheard of in the history of mankind in this century. It all looked grim. It all looked quite impossible. But for a people of faith, their hand in the hand of God, none of it proved to be too much. For there is nothing mightier than his will. And no people that need fear if we put our faith in him. That is the truth of the American founding. It will be the truth of America's salvation. It will be the rock of America's future. Let us build upon it.
If you wish to be placed on our mailing list for notification of future Stealing the Mind conferences, or availability of new audio and videotapes, please call or write Compass International, 460 Canfield, Suite 1000, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83814. Call 1-800-977-2177.